I want to just, first of all, just say a little bit about who I am. As Greg mentioned, I'm a journalist, and I'm a freelance journalist. I live in New York City. And true enough, about 5 years ago, I did become a little bit obsessed with the prison system. I was doing political articles, doing articles about immigration, about welfare, about the lives of ordinary people living in big cities. And I found out that more and more and more of them either had been in prison, or their kids were in prison, or their neighbors were in prison, or somebody close to them in some way was impacted by the criminal justice system. So I started lobbying Greg and saying, look, can I write stories for you about the prison system? And I started lobbying every editor I could think of on this, and I started writing on the prison system. And that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years. So anyway, a few years ago, I started writing my book, which is called Hard Time Blues, How Politics Built a Prison Nation. And the book, what I wanted it to be was an exploration of the lives of individual prisoners. I wanted to put a face on the people who were caught up in this ever-growing prisoner system. And I also wanted to put a face on some of the politicians and some of the activists who had worked so hard to create this prison system. I figured this was a story about individuals as much as it was a story about structures and organizations. So I finished the book a few months ago. It came out last month, and I phoned Greg and told him it had come out, and he immediately said, would you come up and keynote this conference? At which point I told Greg, I don't know anything about Vermont prisons. So I want to reiterate that now before I start. Apologies to any of you who think I'm going to be talking about Vermont. It's not my field. I have not been to any Vermont prisons. I have been to California prisons. I have been to Texas prisons. I've been all over the country, but somehow Vermont missed out. So anyway, apologies for that, and I hope you will hear what I have to say and take it in a national context. Before I start talking about the themes of my speech, I also want to say that events like this, organizations where activists, where concerned citizens come together and talk about what's happening, where people come together and talk about alternatives to the current prison system, where people come together and talk about how we can reform the laws and the political climate and the cultural climate that led to the prison system being so large. These kind of events are incredibly important. So I know it's early in the morning on a very nice Saturday day, but I think it's great that so many people came out today to a conference like this. And I hope you find the workshops interesting, and I hope you leave here feeling empowered to be able to make some of these changes to eventually reshape the prison system and make it a more sane criminal justice system. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about my book, Hard Time Blues. I wanted to focus on individuals, as I said, and I wanted to focus not on people who might, in a sense, be representative of the bad guys, the really, really violent inmates, who there's probably a fairly strong argument should be in prison. I wanted to focus instead on the over 1 million non-violent prisoners who have got caught up in our prison system. Now, just to start with some numbers, 20 years ago, there were about 400,000, maybe 500,000 people in jail and in prison in America. Today, in the year 2002, there are 2 million people living behind bars. That's 1% of the American adult population now lives behind bars. We don't have 5 times as many violent criminals as we did 20 years ago. That's not why there's so many people in prison. What we've had in the last 20 years is a dramatic toughening up of the criminal justice code so that small-time offenders, repeat nuisances, drug addicts, mentally ill, homeless people, people whose lives have been dictated by poverty, these are the people who are getting caught up in the system. So one of the characters in my book is a man called Billy Ochoa. And Billy Ochoa is 58 years old. He's a heroin addict from Los Angeles. And he spent his entire life cycling in and out of jail and in and out of prison. He first went to a juvenile camp in the 1950s. He last went to prison in 1996. In between those 2 times, Billy had spent his life burgling unoccupied houses and committing fraud. He's a very sleazy man. He's a very selfish man. He's committed numerous small crimes. He's not a violent man. He's never had an adult violent felony conviction. In 1996, Billy was arrested in Los Angeles for committing welfare fraud. What he'd done is he'd come out of prison a few years earlier. He had had no money. He was living with his sister. He was still addicted to heroin. Whenever the heroin cravings got too much, instead of burgling houses, which he had done in the past, he committed a small amount of welfare fraud. He'd forge some identity papers, he'd go to a welfare office, he'd apply for food stamp vouchers or for emergency shelter vouchers. And he got away with this for a few months. And eventually the Los Angeles computer systems realized that there was one man applying under various different aliases for welfare. And Billy was arrested, and he went to trial, and he was tried for 13 different counts of welfare fraud. Now, each of these in itself was small, maybe $80 here, $100 there. But because of a law in California called Three Strikes, which is one of these laws that was introduced as part of the toughening up of the criminal justice code, Billy was tried under the Three Strikes law. And this 53, he was 53 years old at the time. This 53-year-old man got convicted of 13 Three Strikes felonies because he committed 13 different counts of fraud. The judge sentenced him to 326 years in prison. Not just in any old prison, but he was sent to a super maximum secure prison because he was deemed to be a flight risk because of the length of his sentence. Now, to my mind, someone like Billy Ochoa represents everything that's gone completely crazy with the criminal justice system. Morally, it doesn't make much sense to put a relatively small-time drug addict, chronic offender, but non-violent offender in prison for life. Economically, it makes even less sense to put someone who committed $2,000 of fraud in a high-security prison environment, which is going to cost $40,000 per year until he dies, to incarcerate him. So that was one of the strands of my story, looking at individual inmates like Billy Ochoa and looking at how the criminal justice system was playing out in their lives and in their families' lives. And I then thought, if you're going to look at inmates, you've got to look at the politicians who've actually benefited from having a tough-on-crime debate over the last 20 years. Because this isn't a system where everyone loses. There are some people who gain. There are private prison companies who gain. There are prison trade union groups who gain when jobs come into their prisons. There are politicians who have spent the last 20 years milking the public sphere on crime and manipulating that fear for their own political agendas. So the second person who I focused on in my book was ex-Governor Pete Wilson, who, in my mind, is one of the most opportunistic, sleazy, god-awful politicians that America conjured up in the 80s and 90s. Now, you know, just for those of you who don't know who Wilson is, let me explain a bit. Wilson developed as a Republican of all Republicans. He developed as a sort of Nixon-type pragmatist Republican. What I mean by that is he didn't come into politics 40 years ago as an ideologue. He came in as someone who was relatively socially moderate, pretty conservative on economics, but, you know, fairly good on the environment, fairly good on gay rights, fairly good on not logging Northern California's redwoods, that kind of thing. As his political career progressed, Pete Wilson realized that the zeitgeist was running in a more conservative direction. And he rode that zeitgeist. He rode it on immigration, where he became one of the staunchest opponents of immigration in California. He rode it on welfare, where he was one of the politicians who led the way in demonizing women with children who were on welfare. And he led the way on crime. And as Pete Wilson's political career progressed, you find Pete Wilson at the forefront of almost every tough-on-crime debate in this country. Pete Wilson advocating the death penalty for, quote-unquote, drug kingpins. Pete Wilson advocating asset forfeiture, whereby local police authorities who arrest people on drug charges can seize their assets, even if they're not convicted of drug crimes. Pete Wilson leading the way on calling for the toughening up of criminal justice codes so that small-time offenders spend longer behind bars. Pete Wilson leading the way in calling for the dismantling of juvenile justice systems and their replacement by harsh adult penalties for teenagers as young as 14. So on all of these counts, Pete Wilson was there, and he framed the political debate in California so that anyone who opposed him could be labeled as soft on crime, as a Mike Dukakis-style liberal. And that's going back a few years, but Mike Dukakis lost the presidential bid to George Bush Sr. 14 years ago, not least because George Bush managed to frame the debate in terms of crime, responses to crime, and appropriate methods of punishment. And on these issues, Dukakis was, quote-unquote, a big L liberal. So Pete Wilson used the criminal justice debate to very successfully run for governor twice, and he came very, very close to mounting a successful presidential bid in 1996. So I figured these were a sort of good point-counterpoint. So in telling those stories, in telling the stories of inmates like Billy Ochoa and politicians like Pete Wilson, and in sprinkling in a fair amount of history and a fair amount of statistics, I hope to be able to tell the story about what's gone wrong with America's criminal justice system in the last generation. Now the question is, why should we care about this? You know, this is a relatively small minority of the population. Some of them have committed bad acts. Many of them are fairly sleazy. They're not necessarily the kind of people you'd want as your next-door neighbors. Why should we care about what's happening to our country? And I want to go back to a maxim which was articulated by Winston Churchill nearly 100 years ago. Now, Winston Churchill wasn't exactly a raving, radical lunatic. He was a fairly conservative person, a member of the British establishment, but he was also someone who understood that for a democracy to survive, it has to have respect, not just for majorities, but also for minorities. And 100 years ago, when Winston Churchill was a young man, when he was Home Secretary in Britain, he said that how a country treats its prisoners should be how a country was considered to be civilized or not civilized. That if a country abused its prisoners, it was uncivilized. If a country could find it in itself to treat its prisoners, its social outcasts, decently, then that was a fairly good measure that it was a civilized country. Now, America today imprisons 2 million people. And as I've been in and out of prison, and as I've interviewed people, and as I'm sure you guys know from your work and from your communications with people inside the prison system, America today does not treat its prisoners well. We take poor people off the streets who've committed crimes that are largely a product of their poverty, and we put them into super secure prison environments. We put them into prisons where many times they're kept in their cells for 23 and a half hours of every day. We put them in prisons where they're only allowed to telephone their families once a week or once every other week. We put them in prisons hundreds of miles from where their families live and from where their communities are. And we make it almost impossible for those they care about to visit them inside prison. There are numerous documented instances of human rights abuses inside prisons, of excess force being used, of prisoners being beaten, of prisoners being electric prodded with stun guns, of prisoners being gassed, having pepper spray and mace used against them. Now, I know that prisons are very tough environments. The jobs of prison wardens and prison guards are very tough. Sometimes those prison guards have a legitimate reason to be fearful. Sometimes they have, in very limited cases, a legitimate reason to use force to subdue a violent inmate. But oftentimes they don't. And oftentimes, inside the prisons where there's no outside scrutiny, abuses of power run rampant. Prisoners who have no access to outside help are left at the mercy of prison wardens who sometimes are racist, sometimes just slightly power-crazed, oftentimes just not knowing how to deal with the situation they find themselves in. There are documented instances in California of inmates being burnt by being put into cauldrons of boiling water. There are instances in California prisons of prison guards pitting rival gang members against them in the prison yards and then shooting them apart with bullets when they don't obey the instant order to separate. There are instances in high-security prisons all over the country where previously sane prisoners have been driven into states of psychosis by being kept in isolation for years at a time. So on all these fronts, America today is failing to live up to that maxim that Winston Churchill laid down a century ago. Now, I'm going to sort of go off on a tangent here about the politics of an open society. We live in a society which claims to be free and democratic, which in many ways is free and democratic. We live in a society where ostensibly how we vote and who we elect matters. But an open society isn't just about majorities. It's not just about the untrammeled rights of majorities to do whatever they like to minorities. For an open society to survive, for the values of an open society to flourish, there have to be built-in mechanisms to protect minorities. Built-in mechanisms to protect the minority from the rampages of an angry majority. Otherwise, you have the politics of the pogrom. What we see in America today is that incredibly vulnerable minorities are being recreated. Yes, there have been certain strides in civil rights laws in the last 40 years. Yes, we don't have legalized segregation anymore. We don't have situations where restaurants and hotels can deny access to clients because of the color of their skin. We don't have housing covenants. In those ways, America has improved in the last 40 years. But in the last 20 years, we have created an equally vulnerable population, equally vulnerable to the abuses of the majority. And that population is made up of prisoners. It's made up of ex-prisoners. It's made up of the families and friends of prisoners. And it's made up of certain communities who are particularly at risk of being sent to prison, especially young African-American and Latino men. And in America today, if you are an African-American male, according to the Bureau of Justice statistics, if you were born in the 1990s, you have a 1 in 3 chance of spending time in prison at some point in your life. Now, after World War II, when the philosophers and the theorists were trying to work out ways of protecting liberal democratic values against totalitarian and fascist tendencies, a philosopher called Karl Popper wrote a book called The Open Society. And the Open Society was a creed, it was a sort of plea for the values of liberal democracy to flourish in an age in which, for many, many reasons, there were all these tendencies and risks for totalitarian, majoritarian rules to go into effect. 60 years, nearly 60 years after the end of World War II, after the writing of the Open Society, I believe that what's happening today with the criminal justice system, as we criminalize entire segments of the population, and as we put an ever greater percentage of people in prison for ever smaller crimes, that the criminal justice system has become the civil rights issue of our time. It's become the critical risk to the future of our open society. Now, this is because of individual actions. It's because of politicians like Pete Wilson. But it's also because we now live in a very fearful culture, very fearful social climate. Many of us might not know anybody who's been convicted of crime. We might not know anybody who's been a victim of crime. But we live in a media society, and our media tells us we're inundated by crime. Our media tells us there's more violent crime, there's more bloody crime, there's more gory crime. Our media shows us images of young gangsters in the inner city, at war with other gangsters and at war with the police. We're perpetually bombarded with images of a country saturated by crime. And we respond in kind. We respond to stimuluses. And if our stimuluses that we're responding to are about images of violent crime, our political responses are likely to be, lock them up. They're all bad. They're all threatening us. Lock them up. Do anything it takes to make a more secure environment for us and for our children. And in doing this, we've created the institutions, the cultural norms, and the social values, which, if we're not careful, will make our open society evaporate before our eyes. As I said earlier, we live in a society where 2 million people are behind bars, where 5 million people are either on probation or parole or behind bars. Because of laws that disenfranchise people who are in prison, and laws in many southern states that permanently disenfranchise anybody who was ever at any time in their life convicted of a felony, we now live in a country where 5 million people are denied the vote. At the last election, 1 in 4 African-American males living in Alabama was denied the vote. In Florida, that state which hopefully some people remember as being a rather controversial one in the presidential election, 700,000 people were denied the vote because of previous felony convictions. 200,000 of those were African American. Now, people often say, doesn't matter, ex-felons, felons, they don't vote. Why should we care? Well, A, we should care because that's their business to choose not to vote. It's not our business to impose disenfranchisement upon them. B, we should care because at the most practical of levels, those vast numbers of disenfranchised people, if they'd been allowed the vote, if only 1% of them had voted, and if those people had split 60-40 in the Democrats' favour at the last election, George Bush would not be president right now. So they matter for very, very practical reasons. We have people in prison for drug offences, which in any other Western democratic country, in any other country that espouses the values of the open society, would be given drug treatment options, community service options. If they were heroin addicts, they'd have access to methadone treatment. They would not be in prison for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years for these minor drug possession offences. We live in a country now which imprisons people like Billy Ochoa at a cost of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for crimes that just did not warrant life sentences in prison. And that money comes from somewhere. You increase the prison sentences for men like Ochoa, you've got to cut education spending. You've got to cut spending on the environment. You've got to cut spending on investments in inner city infrastructures. If you make a conscious policy choice to funnel your public monies into incarceration, then the flip side of that is you're making a public policy choice to not make necessary investments to create a fairer, juster, more equal society. And that's the brute realities. Any country that chooses mass incarceration is making a long-term societal choice to not make the investments that can ultimately create a fairer system. Now, I want to wrap up because I'm getting these signs from Greg here that we've got some kind of time constraints, and I know I've talked for a while. Let me wrap up with another of Winston Churchill's statements. And, you know, I've been looking my whole life for an excuse to quote Winston Churchill in public, so bear with me here. Winston Churchill, who was quite a lush in his time, was stumbling drunk one evening outside the Houses of Parliament. And this rather prim, proper, upright lady accosted him in horror. She said, "Winston, you're drunk." And Winston Churchill drew himself up and he said very proudly, "Madame, I may be drunk, but you're ugly and I shall be sober in the morning." Now, this is, you know, slightly on a tangent, but let me see if I can get away with it. Winston Churchill's rather flippant comment actually bears truth to an underlying reality. Certain things are temporary, and certain things, once created, are unchangeable. Now, politicians come and politicians go. That's a little bit temporary. Crime waves come and crime waves go. That's also a little bit temporary. You know, tomorrow you might read about a particularly heinous murder. You might get all up in arms and say, we need to do something about murderers. A week from now, you might actually read a Bureau of Justice statistics report saying the crime rate is lower now than it's been for 25 years. Crime waves come, crime waves go. They always have, and probably, given human nature, they always will. But once you set in motion the changes that have led to so many people being put in prison for so long, that isn't temporary. Once you set in motion the political climate, the economic climate, the cultural climate, that says that someone like Billy Ochoa should be in prison for 326 years, you've created what my colleague, a journalist called Joel Dyer, terms the perpetual prisoner machine. You've almost created a one-way system where no politician can afford to say, let's re-examine these public policies, because then they're seen to be weak on crime. So you have this bidding war. Who can be tougher on crime? Who can propose ever tougher sentences for ever smaller crimes? Who can make an even stupider public policy pronouncement that will make a good soundbite? Let's go from 3 strikes and you're out to 2 strikes and you're out. Well, let's go to 1 strike and you're out. Well, I can beat that. Why don't we just say, if you commit theft or anything else, we'll just execute you, like they used to do in colonial Britain. So you create this one-way system. And at the end of the day, you've created Winston Churchill's ugly lady. You've created a scarified, ugly political culture and political environment, which looks back wistfully to its youthful days when it was prettier, when it was fairer, but which doesn't have that anymore. which lives its middle-aged years as an ugly, coercive political culture. And when you've done that, you've thrown away the open society that we should all value so much and cherish so much. I don't think it's too late. I think there's still time for people like yourselves to talk about these issues, to educate people about these issues, and to fight like hell for a fairer, more humane criminal justice system that more accurately represents the values that are the best values we could possibly cherish as a democracy. Thank you very much.